I receive regular death threats from the highest ranking politicians in the film, I presume, or their henchmen, who were humiliated by the film. The film exposes them to be corrupt. It exposes their power to be based on fear as a result of their role in the genocide and then ongoing human rights violations since the genocide. So I think I could get into Indonesia, but I don't think I would get out again.
Joshua Oppenheimer's 2012 documentary, The Act of Killing, featured killers boasting about their part in Indonesia's anti-communist massacres of 1965 and 66. In his new film, The Look of Silence, the victims finally speak, and we'll talk to him later in the show. But first, late on Friday here in L.A., a federal judge ruled that the Obama administration must release all undocumented children and their mothers from detention facilities as soon as possible. Judge Dolly G cited widespread and deplorable conditions, and she said the ongoing detention of children violated a two-decade-old court settlement on the housing of immigrant children. Joining me now to talk about that is Peter Shea, executive director of the L.A.-based Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, which brought the lawsuit. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And also, Dara Lynn covers immigration policy and politics for Vox, and she joins us from Washington. Hi, Dara.
Hi.
Well, nice to have you back. Peter, you brought this lawsuit back in February, and the judge ordered you and the administration to negotiate, but I guess you couldn't come to an agreement?
We tried. We were unable to get an agreement that we felt was in substantial compliance with the terms of the Flores settlement, which basically requires that minors in the custody of the federal immigration authorities be held in secure facilities, detention facilities, for no longer than approximately 72 hours, and are then released in order of preference to a family member or other responsible adult or to a licensed group home. And that during the time of their detention, they're in safe and sanitary conditions. Those were the terms that we sought to enforce, and those are the terms we were unable to reach in negotiations. And it now appears those are the terms the court is about to impose.
How many children and their mothers does this cover?
There are several thousand mothers and children who are currently in custody in three separate private for-profit detention operations that the Department of Homeland Security contracts with. And it's those facilities that we hope will effectively come to an end, and that the vast majority of these mothers, we're hoping 95%, will be released along with their children.
Will they be deported or just released?
No, they will be released and will be able to proceed to, most of them have a destination. Most of them have family members here, whether it's a brother, sister, husband, wife, grandparent. Most of them are heading to a destination, to a fixed address. And most of them will then appear for future proceedings before the federal immigration authorities to determine if they have any right to remain here under existing law.
Can you describe the conditions that they were living in? The judge was quite critical of them.
The conditions were really deplorable. They were conditions that we think violate international human rights standards and certainly constitutional standards, and most certainly violated the plain language of the Flores settlement. We found that during the first couple of days in Border Patrol stations that children did not have access to toilets, children did not have access to anything close to adequate meals, children were forced to sleep on the floors, children did not have blankets, they were commingled with other unrelated adults in small spaces. And when they moved out of those pretty deplorable conditions a day or two or 3 days later and were moved to an adult detention center that's operated by these private for-profit institutions, conditions somewhat improved there but continued to be unhealthy and unsafe for the children. So those are the conditions that we believe the court is hopefully going to order the government to correct and is going to give the government 90 days to correct those.
And Dara, what does this mean for the president's immigration policy, this ruling?
Well, I mean, it's become very clear over the last few months that the attempt by the federal government last year to use family detention as a way to, you know, halt the influx of children and families from Central America last year, A, was completely unnecessary because numbers are way down this year for reasons that have nothing to do with detention, and B, had been a massive political failure since the only people who had been particularly attentive about it were advocates and immigrant rights groups who were absolutely appalled about the conditions. So this is yet another defeat in a string of defeats. The government has been trying to come up with a policy that is going to be more lenient in advance of the courts, but it's clear that the courts don't see this as don't see the concessions they've already made as sufficient and are just trying to end the family detention experiment entirely.
Right. So this comes after a federal judge in Texas put what's called DAPA on hold, and remind us what that is.
Sure. So in November, through a series of executive actions, the Obama administration acted to create new programs that would allow about 5 million unauthorized immigrants who are currently in the U.S. to apply for protection from deportation and work permits. This February, the judge in Texas, as you mentioned, put the largest of those programs on hold pending. A set of states had sued the federal government saying that it was unconstitutional for the government to do this. That's currently getting worked out in the courts. It's fairly clear that this is not going to get resolved in the next year or so, possibly not even after that. So what was going to be the, you know, signature achievement of Obama's second term on immigration has been stalled. And meanwhile, the biggest step that the government has taken on enforcement, this family detention experiment, has also been dismantled by the courts.
And then there's also DACA. So there's DAPA, which you were just
right.
mentioning, and DACA, which is basically
right. In 2012, Obama created a process for people who had been brought to the U.S. as children or young teens to apply for protection and work permits. That is still in place, although there's been a little bit of confusion about how long those work permits are good for, thanks to the recent court case. But it's the attempts to expand that to apply to a broader swath of people who were brought here as children and to their parents. Not to their parents, but to parents of U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents. Those two, the expansion and the new parent program, have both been stalled in the courts.
And Peter Shea, what does all this mean for your clients?
Well, I guess I'd have comments both in terms of the detention piece and the DAPA piece. In terms of the detention piece, what it means is hopefully that several thousand mothers and their children will be released fairly promptly from federal government detention in these inhumane conditions. Bottom line, I think they may appeal that. That'll just be for political reasons. They know that their legal position is hopeless. They may appeal that. I think it's highly unlikely that they will get a stay because their position is just so ridiculous, legally speaking. The Flores settlement is plain language. And that's all the court is applying, is the plain language. With regards to DAPA, I think that's a far more complicated question. I think there are steps that the administration could take if the advocates began to advocate in this direction. And I think it's an uphill battle. But I think the Obama administration could go from a losing strategy around DAPA-DACA, which again, as just mentioned, would help several million parents of U.S. citizens come forward and get work permits. I think it could substantially increase its legal position, and the administration must have known that this was going to be challenged. And everything that they did to roll out this program from the way it was written, number one, the wording that was used in the program itself, which left no discretion to individual officers, in effect, it gave virtually no discretion. That was a problem. It turns out that's a legal problem, which I think they knew about when they first drafted this. Number two, the way they put it out, perhaps most importantly, the only reason the injunction was issued at this minute was because the way they put it out was just as a policy. Here's a memo signed by the Secretary of Homeland Security, as opposed to putting it out in the Federal Register as a proposed regulation, giving the public 30 days to comment, and then implementing it as a regulation, which would have quadrupled the legal rights of people getting these temporary work permits, would have strengthened their legal position enormously. It would have... so my point is just that, and thirdly, they made public comments, which were extremely unhelpful to their legal position, which emphasized that there would be no discretion and emphasized that they what they called it a change in law. That's the last thing you want to say about something like this publicly. Mm-hmm. And so those three things, the confluence of those three things, the way that they rolled this out, I think they knew that at best it had about a 25% chance of winning in a legal challenge because of the way they did it.
Mm. It certainly, so you think they didn't want to do it? They just, it was all politics?
They certainly did it in a way. If my goal was to say, I don't care if I only have a 25% chance of winning this in the courts in the long haul, but for the short haul, I want a ton of publicity, then you would give them an A+. There was a way to handle this that probably would have increased their chances in the litigation, and they knew that that was coming mm-hmm. from 25% to, let's say, 75 or 80%. And they could still do this today. And that would be, and they wouldn't have to recede, they could keep fighting this case in the background, but they could tell the courts, and in fact what they could do is to now put out a proposed regulation. They could tinker with it. They could improve it to make it more bulletproof from the standpoint of the challenge that Texas has brought. They could dramatically improve on its language.
But and Dara Lynn, in an election season, that apparently is not going to happen.
I would certainly doubt it. The administration has generally been less than willing to kind of do the most aggressive gung-ho process through the courts. You can see that in the court challenge where they're not doing quite as much as they can to expedite it. They tend to run a little hot and cold on whether they should be as aggressive as they think they possibly can be to protect unauthorized immigrants or whether they think that the law restrains them from doing things that advocates might appreciate.
Dara Lynn covers immigration policy and politics for Vox. Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Coming up on the program, it's our regular TV segment, our TV experts review. I am Kate, Caitlyn Jenner's reality series, plus why millennials are abandoning TV in droves. That's next on Press Play.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Okay. It's like 4:32 in the morning. And I can't sleep. God, I look in the monitor, I look like crap. I feel bad that these, especially young people, are going through such a difficult time in their life. We don't want people dying over this. We don't want people murdered over this stuff. What a responsibility I have.
That was Caitlyn Jenner in her new docuseries, I Am Kate. It debuted last night, and it was one of the most anticipated new TV shows of the year. We're going to talk about that and more in television news today with Michael Schneider, Chief Content Officer for TV Guide Magazine. Hi there.
Good to see you.
And also June Thomas, culture critic for Slate and editor of its LGBTQ section, Outward. Hi, June.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, June, what did you think of I Am Kate?
I was fascinated by it, really. I'd heard ahead of time that it was boring. That's what some critics, even critics who love reality television and are very supportive of Caitlyn Jenner, said that in trying to be responsible and not at all crass or exploitative, it had gotten a little dull because reality television needs conflict. It needs drama, and there wasn't really that much drama. And I think that's true. But I also think that there's a huge educational benefit to these shows. You don't always hear the right pronouns. It's not perfect. Mm-hmm. But just exposing these issues to, you know, the audience that knows the Kardashians and, you know, is interested in this kind of show, I think is super helpful to the world.
Yeah, I think it's damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yes.
If there was drama, it would have felt very manufactured. I mean, we have to remember, and Caitlyn brings this up several times throughout the episode, is that she's actually lucky in that, you know, she's got this support group, the support system in place that's actually been pretty supportive of her. She also is very wealthy and is able to sort of, you know, work through some of this because of her position as both both a major celebrity and also a very wealthy celebrity. So her experience is very different from the majority of people who are struggling with these issues. And she acknowledges that. And I think what was probably most interesting about this first episode is how emotional it was. They smartly brought in her mother for the first episode, who obviously is still struggling with this, who's very supportive. Her entire family, including her sisters, very supportive, but they're also still dealing with it. And at the end of the episode, even Caitlin says, you know, everyone's saying the right things, they're doing the right things, but a lot of her family members haven't come over to see her. Mm. You know, a lot of the Kardashians haven't shown up.
There are other episodes to come.
That's true. This is true.
Well, I guess I'm wondering how much of it is staged and manufactured versus actual genuine reactions.
It's a reality show. So, yeah, I mean, some of it obviously is scheduled. Clearly, the cameras were there for the moment when Caitlin's mother comes. And, you know, all of this has been planned well in advance.
Although they do show the moment when the mom sees her for the first time, when one of her daughters sees her for the first time.
I mean, to some degree, that's authentic. To some degree, you know, whenever there is a camera present, it can't be 100% mm-hmm. authentic, because clearly everyone who comes into contact with the cameras knows I'm being watched and I have to perform for the camera. And that's always been the reality of reality TV.
Yeah.
By the way, one other thing that kind of struck me about the first episode of I Am Kate is we saw the other side of Kanye West, who visited along with Kim Kardashian. It's smiling, mild-mannered, gentle Kanye West.
In the background, not in the foreground.
A little bit of both.
He's got some major small talk skills.
So that was pretty fascinating to see.
Okay, moving on to another Caitlin. The season finale of The Bachelorette is tonight, and the season has been a little controversial because Caitlin Bristow has broken the rules and slept with a contestant before the fantasy suite dates, and some viewers have not liked that. Here's the host on last week's episode reading some of the tweets about Caitlin.
You're the worst bachelorette ever in history. You're a little whore. So shut your little whore mouth. Hashtag slut.
Wow. June, is this something that we actually want to see and hear on TV?
I don't know. It does seem shocking. Yeah. However, it's funny that we all get so tweaked out when something real happens on reality television. I mean, these seasons, we're so deep into The Bachelor and The Bachelorette these days. And it's always been clear that the fantasy suites are just, what, a couple of weeks later and suddenly it's okay then. You know, there was a shock, I think, a couple of years ago on The Bachelor when The Bachelor accidentally, you know, confessed that sex happens in the fantasy suite, and somehow making it explicit made everyone freak out. And it just, to me, it's amusing. I mean, what did we think was going on in this show? What did we think this show was about?
Yeah.
If anything, this is more an indictment for social media than anything else. Once again, people feel comfortable for whatever reason on social media to be cruel. And really, just what's the point?
All right. Last night, also the latest episode of True Detective, and there's a pivotal confrontation between Colin Farrell's character and Vince Vaughn. Colin Farrell's character accusing Vince Vaughn of tricking him into killing a man. Here's a clip.
That name on the piece of paper, whoever he wasn't the man who hurt my wife.
I didn't know about it. I thought the info was solid.
Okay, Michael, this second season of the show has been just panned by critics, rightly so.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people are saying that, you know, they're sort of a little frustrated with dialogue that they consider pretentious and a lot of sort of directions that the show goes that sort of ultimately don't go anywhere. And so I understand their frustration. You know, what's interesting is I've been watching it from a different perspective, living in Los Angeles, and the sort of, you know, the big story this season is sort of loosely based on the real life city of Vernon mm-hmm. here in Southern California, which, you know, if you live here, it is a fascinating story of this industrial city with only a population of about 95 people, and the corruption and the amount of investigation that's gone into it over the past couple of years. So if anything, I'm kind of more fascinated by that than I am with the actual character study. So, but yeah. I get the criticism.
June, are you one of the haters?
I am. I'm hate watching. Last season, I didn't get, you know, to me, this was an example of people who only watch HBO, they only watch television on Sunday night, and they think something is revolutionary and out of this world when it's actually a little pretentious and not all that special. Clearly, last season, we had two amazing performances at the center of it from Matthew McConaughey and Mr. Harrelson, and that made a huge difference because they could pull off ridiculous dialogue in a way that Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell, who are fine actors, just can't. I mean, in that clip, the way that Colin Farrell was speaking made me laugh, which I don't think it's supposed to.
Right.
And I think that there are other shows on basic cable that are just as good, in fact, better than this season, that really, you know, deal with complicated storylines and yes, slightly cliched topics for sort of premium television, prestige television. But shows like Murder in the First on TNT, I think, is a really fine show. It's working very similar territory to True Detective, but I think much more successfully.
Murder in the First. Okay, do you have any more recommendations?
I also really like Rookie Blue, which is, people will laugh because it's a Canadian show, which is on ABC in the summer. That really is lined up to be a very poor show. But to me, they deal with really interesting, complicated questions about, you know, law enforcement. And I find it extremely entertaining.
All right. Well, thanks both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's June Thomas, Slate's culture critic and editor of its LGBTQ section, Outward, and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Coming up on the program, the gender politics of air conditioning.
My complaints were about one particular person, and you know who you are, who is always cold and made everybody else in the room keep the air conditioner off.
AC Wars after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 50 years ago, in just 1 year, from 1965 to 1966, around a million people were killed in Indonesia. It was an anti-communist purge mounted by the army and supported secretly by the U.S. and Britain during the Cold War. But most of the victims were not official communists or enemies of the state. They were ordinary people, villagers, who were rounded up and slaughtered. Indonesia has never accounted for that massacre. In fact, the killers remain heroes to this day. Joshua Oppenheimer spent time with some of those killers for his 2012 Oscar-nominated documentary, The Act of Killing. It's really a strange and surreal film with some of the killers gleefully reenacting their crimes. Well, now Joshua Oppenheimer has made a companion film from the victim's point of view. He follows a man who confronts the men responsible for the death of his brother. The movie is called The Look of Silence.
Seandainya aku berbicara di era Orde Baru sama Bapak, apa yang akan Bapak lakukan dengan aku?
Tak bisa kita bayangkan, ya.
And Joshua Oppenheimer joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you. And this is a movie that you made before you made the first one that came out, The Act of Killing, right?
We shot The Look of Silence after editing The Act of Killing, but before it had its first screenings, at which point I knew I could not safely return to Indonesia to do anything else. So there was that window when we could make the film.
So what was the reception of your first film, The Act of Killing?
Inside Indonesia, you could say that The Act of Killing helped catalyze a fundamental transformation in how the mainstream media and consequently the public talk about the country's past. Whereas before, with very few exceptions, the media was silent about the genocide or else talked about the heroic extermination of the Indonesian left. Now the media talks about the genocide as a genocide, and they talk about the terrible present-day legacy of the genocide, the awful regime that the killers have built, with and unprecedented honesty.
And so what has the fallout been then for the country's leaders?
Well, when the act of killing was nominated for an Academy Award, the government of Indonesia, the president's spokesman said, look, we know what happened in 1965 was a crime against humanity. We know we need truth and reconciliation. He went on to criticize the film, but it was a wonderful moment because it was the first time they ever admitted it was wrong. In a way, you could say that this opened the way for The Look of Silence, which has had a much wider release in Indonesia, something unimaginable for The Act of Killing, which began its life in secret. The first screening of The Look of Silence in Indonesia was held in the largest theater in Indonesia. There were billboards announcing it around Jakarta. It was a venue for 1,500 people. 3,000 came. They put on a second show. The main character, Adi Rukun, who bravely confronts the men who killed his brother, even though they're still in power, and threaten him. He came to both screenings and received a 15-minute standing ovation after each one.
He's an optometrist, a village optometrist. And what he does in your film is he's watching clips of your interview of the killers from your previous film.
Well, actually, from before I made the previous film, I started shooting The Act of Killing in 2005 when I met Anwar Kongo, the main character in that film. He was the 41st perpetrator I'd filmed, though, and I'd spent 2 years filming the first 40. And it's those men who were involved with killing Adi's brother whom Adi is studying. He's studying this old footage to prepare for these confrontations.
So he's watching this footage, and then he goes and he meets these men who are neighbors. Right?
Some of them are neighbors. Others are prominent, regionally powerful politicians.
And in some cases, he goes as their optometrist. And he's fitting them for eyeglasses. And he kind of, in a banal way, brings up this very important topic, the killing of his brother. And I just want you to talk about that whole process of how he was able to do this and why he wanted to do this.
Well, you see, I had worked with Adi from the very beginning of my journey in Indonesia. I started working with him and his family in 2003, and he was bringing survivors to me to tell me their stories. And 3 weeks into that process, the army threatened all of the survivors not to participate in the film. So Adi had called me to this secret meeting in his parents' house at midnight, because we were all under surveillance, to tell me, please don't give up. Try to film the perpetrators. And I was afraid to do so at first, but when I overcame that fear and approached them, I encountered this surreal, horrific boasting, this openness, that it took nothing to get them to open up. And Adi wanted, of course, to see that material. After all, he'd sent me to shoot it. And when I showed it to him, he and then other survivors, the broader Indonesian human rights community, everybody who saw it said, continue to film the perpetrators. You're onto something so important, because anyone who hears the way they're speaking will be forced to acknowledge that in a terrible way the genocide hasn't ended, because the perpetrators are still in power and people's lives are still being destroyed by fear. And 7 years later, when I returned to make The Look of Silence, I sat down with Adi, not yet sure he would be the main character, just knowing he would be a collaborator. And he said, I've spent 7 years watching your material with the perpetrators. It's changed me. I need to meet the men who killed my brother. I said, no. Immediately, I said, no, it's too dangerous. We cannot do it. And Adi said, let me explain why it matters. And actually, he showed me one clip, one scene, the only scene in The Look of Silence that Adi shot. And it's this scene he shot with his father when I wasn't there, where his father's crawling through his own home, lost, calling for help. And Adi said, you see, my father's forgotten the son whose murder destroyed our family's life, but he hasn't forgotten the fear. So he will now die in a prison of fear because it's too late for him to heal. And I don't want my children to inherit this from my father, my mother, from me. And I think if I go and visit the perpetrators gently, not out of revenge, but just trying to understand, they will welcome this as this long, unconsciously hoped for opportunity to be forgiven, to find forgiveness from one of their victims' families, and they will accept what they've done is wrong.
But they didn't.
They don't.
And in fact, in some of the confrontations in your movie, they get angry and they threaten him.
Exactly. So I actually was moved by Adi's request, this desire to have reconciliation with his neighbors so his children needn't grow up afraid of their neighbors the way he has. And I went and spoke to my crew, and they said, well, Joshua, you see, the production of your first film, The Act of Killing, was well known across this region, no one's seen it yet. So everyone believes that you're close to some of the most powerful men in the country who appear in the film, the vice president, the governor of the province, the head of all the paramilitary, the national head of the paramilitary movement. And the men Adi wants to confront are regionally, not nationally powerful. So they will not dare detain you, let alone physically attack you. So maybe you can do this. I went and said that. I said to Adi, perhaps we can do this safely. Maybe I was wrong. But we have to be prepared to stop. We have to take many safety precautions. And exactly, I do not think they will find the courage to apologize, I said. I think that they will panic. You looking at them as human beings deserving of forgiveness will make them see that you are a human being, and therefore Ramli, your brother, was a human being, and all of their victims are human beings. And the facade that the lies they've been telling themselves so they can live with themselves will come crumbling down, and they'll panic, and they'll get angry, and they'll get defensive, and they may threaten us. But if I can show that precisely, I can show how torn this social fabric of Indonesia is. I can show the abyss of fear dividing people. And we can make anyone who sees the film support truth and reconciliation. So I told Adi, perhaps we will succeed through the film in a bigger way where we might fail in these individual confrontations. And indeed, they get angry. And indeed, it was frightening physically to shoot.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Joshua Oppenheimer about his new documentary. It's called The Look of Silence. So they got angry and they threatened Adi. And how were you able to make sure that he was safe and that the crew was safe and that they didn't go after them? Because here they are, powerful men still in this village.
Well, first of all, while we were shooting, we would take such precautions as having a getaway vehicle so Adi could escape first without being followed. We would have Adi's family packed and ready to evacuate at the airport while we were shooting the confrontations with the more powerful perpetrators. I would shoot with no Indonesian members of the crew. I would use only a Danish crew. I live in Copenhagen. And then 6 months before the film came out, we met in Thailand because I cannot safely return to Indonesia as a result of my first film, The Act of Killing.
Why not?
I receive regular death threats from the highest ranking politicians in the film, I presume, or their henchmen, who were humiliated by the film. The film exposes them to be corrupt. It exposes their power to be based on fear, and as a result of their role in the genocide and then ongoing human rights violations since the genocide. So I think I could get into Indonesia, but I don't think I would get out again. And so we met in Thailand with Adi's family, with the crew from the film, with the people who released The Act of Killing in Indonesia, and with some human rights activists and lawyers. And we said, what should we do? And they watched the film and they said, Adi's family said, if this film can come out now, it must, because there's so much momentum for change right now as a result of The Act of Killing. This was just a couple months after the Academy Awards where The Act of Killing had been nominated. And then my team from Indonesia said, you know, I think if because of the change that's taken place already, Adi will be seen by many in Indonesia as a national hero. And so we should see if it's possible to protect Adi's family's safety inside Indonesia first, even if it means the family should move. It involved assembling a team of 5 people working full-time, another 20 people working in different capacities part-time, moving the family thousands of kilometers from where we made the film out from under the shadow of the men who've been threatening them for so long. We've been able to put the children in much better schools. You see in the film Adi's son being sort of brainwashed in this awful sort of exercise in state propaganda in school. The children are in better schools. And we raised money for Adi to open a brick-and-mortar optometry shop so he no longer has to go door-to-door selling glasses. You can say that we've tried to turn this difficult situation into a series of opportunities for the family with a plan B that if the family's threatened, they move to Europe.
Well, does he forgive his neighbors? Does he forgive the men who killed his brother?
Adi's prepared to. I think Adi's point, and I've learned this from Adi, is that every perpetrator is actually a human being. And we may hope that if we grew up in their families in that time, in that come 1965 we would make different decisions, but we know that we're very lucky never to have to find out. And that goes for the survivors too, in fact. Adis cannot, though, forgive someone who's unable to admit what they've done was wrong. But what the film shows, and I think my first film, The Act of Killing, explores this in other ways, is that it's almost impossible for perpetrators to sincerely, in the moment, consciously, consistently acknowledge what they've done was wrong, unless they're forced to, because they would have to live with the trauma of guilt. And at the end of my first film, The Act of Killing, you see the main character, Anwar Kongo, retching over the dawning realization that what he did was wrong. Even then, if you see the uncut version of the film, the so-called what's been released on Netflix as the director's cut, you see Anwar still lying, still saying, my conscience told me they had to be killed, even while he's retching. So I think that Adi can't yet forgive people who cannot acknowledge what they've done was wrong. In the film, however, there's a daughter of one perpetrator who finds the courage and the humanity to acknowledge what he did was wrong. And it's this moment where her father tells Adi these horrible details of what he's done, and we see her face just collapse as she realizes that he's not the man she's hoped him to be, really. Mm-hmm. And yet, instead of doing what I think I would do, which is to panic and kick the film crew out of the house, she becomes very still, listens to her conscience, and apologizes. And actually reaches out across this abyss that would divide her and Adi and hugs him and says, let us be a family. And
it's funny because I saw that scene differently. I saw that scene as her trying to make it better. She was asking Adi to forgive her father and in a sense, in that same way, absolve him and absolve her.
I don't think you're entirely wrong. I think these are not exactly contradictory views. It's a matter of different emphasis. Because I think that Adi says to her very clearly, it's not your fault what your father's done. And I think they're trying to make it better for each other, suggesting that even if Adi can't forgive the men who killed his brother because they're threatening him and they can't acknowledge what they've done is wrong, if there's hope, it's in the next generation. It's in people Adi's age and younger and her age and younger.
How do you want us to see the perpetrators? Because, as I said earlier, they brag about their crimes. In this film, they admit to some absolutely horrific acts, like drinking the blood of their victims.
I think Primo Levi, speaking of the perpetrators of the Holocaust, said this very beautifully when he said, there may be monsters among us, but they are too few to worry about. What we have to really worry about are the ordinary people. And I think that we want to think they're monsters so that we can feel we have nothing to do with them. We have not that they're not, and that of course would be to reassure ourselves. And is it not the only hopeful response to these kind of atrocities to say that every perpetrator in our history has been a human being like us? And while we might hope that we would not make the same choices as they would if we grew up in their families in that time, in that context, we're very lucky never to have to find out. Is that not the only hopeful response? Because it suggests that then if they're human, we ought to be able to find ways of building societies where we live together and we encourage people, we teach our children to practice the widest possible empathy and to practice doubt for what authority tells them so that it's harder to incite people to join groups that are doing things that would betray our individual morality. It seems like this is the only hopeful response. It's frightening, but when you get over that fear, once you say, okay, let's assume they are human, then comes hope.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joshua Oppenheimer is the director of a new documentary. It's called The Look of Silence. It's in theaters now. And Warren Olney is here now, giving me a look.
Hello.
Hello.
That was a look of delight and pleasure and a nice to see you look. We're going to be talking today on To the Point about the president's visit to Ethiopia and Kenya, first sitting president ever to go to those countries, of course. And while there's Obama mania in Kenya and a lot of talk of how the United States is way behind, particularly behind China, cultivating these economies that are growing so fast that we've hardly even paid attention to it, There's also a concern that he is, by virtue of being there, giving the green light, to, particularly in Ethiopia, to very serious human rights violations by the government there, in response, of course, to attacks by jihadists. But nonetheless, I think you could at least call them overreaction to attacks by jihadists, and that's been true in Kenya as well, where Jomo Kenyatta, who he appeared with, has been accused of war crimes, although the evidence wasn't sufficient, and that charge has been withdrawn. Nonetheless, there's controversy about this. It's very interesting. And, of course, he was eloquent. Again, Obama mania is the only term for what for the way he was received
right,
in Kenya.
Right.
And it was fun to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that looks look forward to that at 1 o'clock on KZW on To the Point. Thank you, Warren Olney. And coming up on this show, if you're one of those people, I'm one of those people, who brings a sweater to the office in the summertime, the next segment we have is for you, why air conditioning in the office is gendered. That's next on Press Play.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's hot out, and so we've been having this debate around our office lately.
The office. Too hot? Too cold?
It's not just hot. It's swampy. It's like Miami in summer.
It depends on what room you're in. There's like microclimates. Most offices tend to be frigid.
Air conditioning or au naturel. Things can really get pretty heated.
My complaints were about one particular person, and you know who you are, who is always cold and made everybody else in the room keep the air conditioner off.
Well, the office debate is one thing. We'll get to that in a bit. But air conditioning has more serious implications, too, for climate change, the economy, even personal well-being. Joining me to discuss all of this is Stan Cox, author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Hi, Stan.
Hi, Madeline.
And Alan Hedge, professor of design and environmental analysis at Cornell University. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Madeline.
All right, well, let's talk about this debate within the offices that you always hear. You always hear that, you know, offices are frigid in the United States. And do you find that to be generally true, that we keep the temperatures too low? And I'm saying this as I'm wearing a sweater.
The answer is yes. Invariably, temperatures are too cold in summertime in U.S. buildings.
And why is that?
The main reason is that our thermal comfort standards come from a series of experimental studies that were done and published in the early 1970s. And based on that, they developed what was called the comfort envelope. And that has driven the design of U.S. buildings. And in the summertime, that means that the envelope is usually between about 72 to a maximum of 74 Fahrenheit. And in wintertime, that envelope can be slightly lower than that.
All right. So, Stan, 72 to 74 degrees, that's not comfortable. It's cold.
That's right. And it's not only a matter of comfort. There have been a number of studies in various countries, including the U.S., showing that people working in continuous air conditioning tend to have to go to the hospital more or into the doctor more and have generally lower overall health rating than people who work in non-air conditioned spaces.
Well, why is that? Because the air is recycled?
They're not sure exactly why, but a lot of it does have to do with the indoor air quality. One thing that air conditioning does is to, and by cooling the mucous linings of our nose, et cetera, makes us not notice smells that are there anyway.
Well, Alan, what about this difference between men and women?
Okay, so the first thing is that you kind of need to differentiate between what's a comfortable temperature, how do bodies work, and then how do we cool the environment. So just because, let me take those in reverse, just because in your office it might be set to 72, the air conditioning system is actually blowing air into your office that probably is in the low 50s. And if you happen to be sitting beneath a ventilation supply duct, or if you happen to be sitting with exposed ankles, that cold air falls down, moves moves along the floor and is supposed to gradually warm up and get sucked out of the room. It's a crazy design because you're bringing cold, clean air or cleaner air in and bringing it down through warm and more polluted air and hopefully trying to get the two things to mix. So first of all, functionally, there's a problem with the design of a lot of the systems. Now, when we look at the gender differences, as far as we know, if we control for everything like clothing and activity and age and food intake and drink intake, there are no fundamental differences between men and women in what they find as a comfortable temperature. However, functionally, there are huge differences. Men, weight for weight, have more muscle than women. Muscle generates body heat, so men tend to have warmer skins often by several degrees than do women. Men have more sweat glands and sweat more effectively, so they can cool off more easily than can women. Women have a layer of subcutaneous fat that makes their skin much smoother than a man's skin, but that layer doesn't extend over the feet and over the hands and over the back of the neck. And typically when you ask, is a person cold, they're often complaining of cold feet, cold hands, cold back of the neck, not that the whole body is cold. Then you have functional clothing differences. Men often are wearing long pants, maybe socks and shoes, sometimes a shirt, a tie, a jacket. Women usually have exposed feet or, you know, minimal footwear, exposed legs. They're wearing a skirt. They're wearing a blouse with an open neck. And so when you look at thermal insulation values, there's usually a huge difference. In the workplace, most women tend to be doing jobs that are more sedentary. And when you sit down, you generate less body heat than when you stand up and move around. And you're also likely to be sitting in a normal chair versus an executive chair, which adds a huge amount of thermal insulation around the body. So gender differences in temperature complaints are very, very widespread.
And then also, who's setting the temperature? That's also a question.
Right.
And Stan, if this is the number one complaint in the summertime in offices, why don't people just turn the temperature up a little bit, make it more comfortable?
Well, as you said, Madeline, often people in the workplace don't have control of the thermostat if it's a large office.
Well, they need to mount a revolution or something.
Yeah, you know, I think people tend to take the more personal approach, I guess, and take sweaters to work or space heaters. Actually, I'm sitting here right now. I have a blanket hanging in front of the air conditioning vent because otherwise that 50-degree air would be blowing right into the back of my neck.
This seems like an awful big waste of resources and energy.
It is, and it seems like people ask, well, what can we do about our overall air conditioning consumption? And this seems as good a place as any to start. And I have kind of in the past called for the revolution you're talking about, or at least an uprising of America's workers to try to get something done about this.
But then can't you just picture it? Once the temperature goes up, people are going to start complaining about that.
Yeah, that's almost sure to happen. But there is what's called the adaptive model of comfort that says that range that was decreed way back when is not a fixed thing, and that in controlled experiments, when people are asked, are you comfortable at this temperature or that one, those who have been experiencing warmer temperatures in recent days or weeks tend to prefer a higher temperature range. Their body has acclimatized to those higher temperatures.
What's the highest temperature, do you think, before people start complaining?
Well, some studies in Thailand, now these weren't Americans, so they were probably tougher than we tend to be, but it was in the mid or even upper 80s that they were still getting as many as 80% of the people saying they were fine.
Upper 80s, okay. Well, I don't know about that. Alan, what about productivity? Does productivity go up the colder it is, as we like to think?
No, it's the other way around. All of our research shows that the colder you are, the less productive you actually are. And I want to follow through on what you said. I'm sitting here in Southwest Florida. I have my thermostat set to 80 degrees, and it feels really cool in here because outdoors it's in the mid-90s. So everything is relative, and the adaptive model is powerful. And we do have precedents here for what we can do about it. In 2005, the Japanese government introduced an initiative called Cool Biz. And what they said was they wanted to save energy, they wanted to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, and they said that from June the 1st through October 31st, all government buildings had to set their thermostat at 82 Fahrenheit. Right? And then they said to the employees, now 82, you might find it warm with the clothing you're wearing, so you can have a relaxed clothing policy. If you want to come in shorts and a T-shirt, you know, sandals, that's fine. And what this has done, it not only is it saving the equivalent of the carbon dioxide emissions of about 2.5 million homes, but it spawned a whole new clothing industry. And that clothing industry is called Cool Biz Clothing.
Okay, there's hope that one day we will get rid of our sweaters in the summer. I can't wait.
Absolutely.
Alan Hedge is a professor of design and environmental analysis at Cornell University, and Stan Cox, author of Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Thank you both.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, Madeline.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello. I can't help but notice that both of us are rocking a pretty comprehensive cardigan situation in here.
I know.
I think that QED. Tells people what they need to know. Our listeners went bonkers over this topic. Lambchop Atkinson says on Facebook that she is constantly miserable when men are comfortable in the office. She says that she doesn't buy that it's a conspiracy against women in the workplace, but blissful ignorance on the part of men is still a problem. But Lolita Perez says that if you're cold, wear a sweater. If you're hot, you can't take off your clothes. And Matt Briggs says that it's a scientific fact that women are never happy no matter what the temperature is. LOL.
I'd like to see the data on that. All right, Jolie Myers, thank you very much. If you want to weigh in, Twitter is at KCRW Press Play, or Facebook, KCRW Press Play. We're on the and to the point up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon. I'm Madeline Brand. Brr.